Hello and welcome to yet another enthralling. Let's go enthralling today. An enthralling Cooper Talks podcast. Carrying on the little series I'm doing at the moment on Russia and the various revolutions of 1917 and the Bolshevik uprising. So today I'm going to be looking at the impact of World War One on Russian history, which is quite big, particularly the political history, and looking at why World War One led to the abdication of the Tsar, Tsar Nicholas II, in February 1917. So if you haven't already, it's worth listening to the previous podcast I did on the Tsarist recovery after the 1905 revolution. But essentially, by the time World War One broke out in 1914, by the time war broke out in summer of 1914, Russia politically had effectively returned to a system of autocracy, with the fundamental laws ensuring the Tsar's supremacy, the Duma being marginalised, and effectively most of the promises of the October Manifesto ignored. And when World War One breaks out, one of the first things that happens is that the Duma is basically dissolved. So this was the fourth Duma that was quite docile. Said, no, there's a war going on, don't need the Duma anymore. And that's going to be quite important later on. But let's just think about what actually happened during World War One. So if we go to the start of the war, the Germans had a plan by a general called von Schlieffen, and it's called the Schlieffen Plan, which you may or may not have studied in Year 9 history, because that's when it usually gets studied. And the plan was, the Germans thought, right, they'd knock out Russia and then invade France, and they'd be able to do all that in 6 weeks thanks to railways. And they thought this because the plan was devised before the Russian failures of the Russian-Japanese War and the reforms that Russia had made. And Russia had actually made great steps to sort of modernise and improve things. So when the Germans came marching in 1914, they were a bit surprised that the Russian army was actually better organised and prepared than they'd anticipated. So initially the war went quite well, actually, for the Russians. So they make quite a good advance. And, you know, they, unlike most nations at the time, they had a lot of people, big country, but a lot of people, 1.4 million men were in the army with another 3 million in reserve who'd been trained up. So make that just in numbers of people. That was the largest army in Europe. And as I said, it had re-armed and modernised since the Russia-Japanese War. So it was a very different prospect from what it had been 10 years previously. However, it did still have some major issues. One of them being that most of its generals owed their position to nepotism rather than ability. And there were a lack of good quality officers because it was all about being part of the aristocracy and being connected rather than actually knowing what you were doing. Also, the physical condition and education of ordinary soldiers was very low compared to other countries in Europe. And they also had the problem when they started conscripting troops that because a lot of people from different regions of Russia identified more with their local region, they didn't really want to fight for Russia. So although they were part of the Russian Empire, people in Ukraine, Belarus, Latvia, Lithuania, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Finland even, initially, they all saw to themselves as Ukrainian or Kazakh or Chechen, anything else. And they were like, well, why are we fighting for the Russians? This is a Russian war. It's nothing to do with us. And so they weren't, for that reason, as loyal as, say, a lot of the Germans were, who identified as German, or the French, who saw themselves all as French and fighting for France. So there's going to be a bit of a problem with the ordinary soldiers, and also, for various reasons, they just don't have they're not as physically strong fit. The diet's not as good because of the nature of farming and so on in Russia. And that's going to be a particular problem for Russia because of this weak condition and because they don't identify as closely with being Russian as in other countries. They're going to be much more willing to desert or refuse to fight and going to be less cohesive as a force than other militaries. And the big one, because even though there had been progress in industrialization, still the Russian army was poorly equipped, had a lot of men, but they didn't have enough of the modern machinery of warfare. So modern artillery, the big guns that would dominate the Western Front, machine guns, which the Germans would use, even motorized vehicles that could transport things quickly. Even a shortage of basic things like rifles and bullets in the early stages of the war. The army needed at least 100,000 new rifles a month, but the Russian industry at the time could only supply 27,000. So it doesn't matter how many men you've got. If they haven't got weapons, it's going to be pretty hard to fight. Now, as everyone did at the start of World War One, Russia and its generals wanted a very quick war, and they thought they could just steamroller through Germany. And to be fair, that's what Britain and France thought would happen as well. That's where the term steamroller comes from. And they thought it would happen very quickly. However, this didn't work, because in the autumn of 1914, Russia, although it had got to German territory, there were two major battles, one at Tannenberg and one at the Masurian Lakes. And basically, the superior German weaponry and tactics stopped the army dead there. And there were horrible reports, absolute massacre, because the Germans were able to use machine guns and the generals had ridden horses into sort of a quagmire. The Germans had started developing trench warfare to defend themselves. It was just the Russians were stopped in their tracks. And then it got even worse, because in 1915, what the Russians called the Great Retreat saw the Russian forces driven out of Poland, Lithuania, parts of Belarus as well, all of which had been part of the Russian Empire. So big loss of really important territory, which was seen as humiliating, particularly with about a million men being killed or wounded and another million captured by the Germans. So this was a huge loss to the Russian war effort and seen as humiliating. In 1916, they're going to try again to launch a counterattack known as the Brusilov Offensive after the general. And this was to target Austria, try and knock Austria, Germany's ally, out of the war. And while it had some initial success, ultimately it failed as soon as the Germans came backing the Austrians. So really, despite a very good early start, very soon it became clear that the Russians could not compete with the German military, and they'd been pushed back into what had been traditionally Russian territory. So that's a humiliation and a major problem that's going to shake the confidence of a lot of people in Russia. And this is where a leader needs to step up. Okay, unfortunately, Nicholas II was not that sort of man. Although he does try, and we'll come to that. Now, other things that happened during wartime, there are economic problems. And unlike a lot of the other countries, Russia was in a much poorer position going into the war to be able to cope with these. No one was expecting a long drawn out war. And so no one had planned to stockpile quantities of munitions and build up supplies and so on like that. Now Britain and France had the industrial capacity, as did Germany, to start manufacturing lots and turn over to a wartime economy. But Russia just didn't have the infrastructure. It didn't have the factories or machinery to be able to supply enough munitions for the front. So it had to order munitions from the British and American arms manufacturers. America wasn't in the war till 1917, but it was quite happy to sell weapons and stuff and munitions. For various reasons, partly supply, because very difficult to get to Russia, because the Germans controlled the Baltic Sea, which meant you either go to the north, which is frozen most of the time, or you have to go from Siberia and use the Trans-Siberian Railway, all very difficult. And because they were busy fighting their own wars, a lot of the contracts weren't met. And this resulted in 1915 with a munitions crisis, which is political as well as economic, because the government's opponents, different opposition parties, just pointed to it and said, see, this is how inept and incompetent the Tsarist regime is, can't even provide enough bullets to fight a war. Now, this causes the Tsar and his ministers to set up a special committee for state defence to try and take over arms production and build new factories. But again, it's kind of too little too late. they start building new factories and spending time doing that. It does improve the supply of munitions by 1916. However, despite them overcoming this economic loss, eventually the political damage was pretty decisive. And the Tsar, as a result, got the blame for the great retreat and the catastrophic losses. So he wants to be a hero, but he's actually very much seen as the villain of the piece. He gets the blame. Whether it's deserved or not doesn't matter. He is blamed for the munitions crisis, and that is what the people decide had led to the Great Retreat. Now, at the same time, Russia's transport system being quite heavily based on the Trans-Siberian Railway, which is just one track. It's very important, but it is just a single track. And for this reason, they give military traffic on it priority. What that means is non-military traffic, which includes food supplies, will have to wait for military traffic to go past. So, as I said, a lot of the military munitions orders from overseas would end up in Vladivostok. And so those munitions would have to go all the way across the Trans-Siberian Railway and end up in the Western Eastern Front, West for Russia, East from a German point of view. But while they were waiting, trains with food supplies for the cities, for the ordinary people, would be seriously delayed, like by days. And that could mean that the food would actually be rotting by the time it reached the cities. And that is going to contribute to major food shortages and rising food prices in Russian towns and cities. And wages are not rising. So that's going to link into inflation. So this is going to cause hunger and starvation in the cities. And again, the Tsar is going to get the blame for this. So, yeah, inflation is a big problem. Partly, as I said, the transport there is slowing things down. But also because you're taking a lot of the young peasant men from the countryside to go and fight in this war, means grain production fell. Also, the fact that a lot of the really good growing soil was in the European part that the Germans had just occupied, that's also going to limit the amount of grain they've got access to. Some of the peasants and some business speculators, they're going to hold on to their grain supplies, keep them dry, keep them safe, in the hope that the prices will go up and they'll be able to make more of a profit. So instead of selling the grain, they actually hoard it, which drives up prices further. And yeah, all of this contributes to massive inflation. And it's the urban working class that are particularly badly hit by this. Their wages did go up slightly during the war, but the prices went up far faster. So for example, in Petrograd, skilled workers' wages doubled between 1914 and 1917, but food went up by five times at the same time. And there was even, and that was five times just for a bag of flour. Potatoes went up by seven times the amount. So, you know, prices going up by five times, wages going up by double, it's going to lead to much, much greater hardship. This will only impact the peasantry in the later stages of the war. Because obviously they have access to the food, but when stuff coming out of the cities ends up becoming more expensive, like food and clothes and things like that. But it will eventually affect everyone. Now, following the Great Retreat of 1915 and all the history of the Tsar said, I'm going to take some decisive action. And he decided he was going to travel to the front, okay, to become one with the military. Most people thought this was a really bad and stupid idea. His generals, his ministers said, no, you'll become a target there. Also, if there's any more failures, you'll get the blame because you're actually there. I mean, you're already getting the blame, but you'll be even more responsible because you're at the front. But he insisted, he said, no, I need to set an example. I need to go to the front, show that I'm with the soldiers. So coming from a good place, you could say. And so he travels in late 1915 to the front. This has two effects. I mean, the first one is it does create a symbol, but it's not as powerful as he might have hoped, because most people really didn't care. At the front, to their great relief, the generals realized he wasn't actually going to get involved in anything. He was just going to be present at the front, which again kind of makes him a bit superfluous. He's just there as a symbol, but he at least he's not going to try and dictate things and order the generals what to do. The bigger political problem was it left a power vacuum to a degree back in Petrograd. So while the Tsar was always in charge, the day-to-day running of the country is now left in the hands of the Tsarina. Okay, he leaves his wife in charge. That might not necessarily be a bad thing, except the Tsarina has a lot of flaws. She is German, and that's not going to go down well. She's also very conservative, and she's going to refuse to work with anyone from the sort of middle classes. She's very strong-willed. She's also a bit unstable as well, so she can be a bit erratic at times. And she's adamant, and she basically would be the one trying to stop her husband making concessions or compromise or anything like that. At the same time, as I talked about in the last podcast, there is Rasputin. And Rasputin is hated in the society and believed to have a huge influence. And with these two left, effectively, or the perception is that they're running the country, this is going to seriously damage the Tsar and the whole regime's reputation. Now, the truth is, as I said last time, Nicholas II was, you know, he was just symbolically at the front. So any failures at the front did not come from the influence of the Tsarina or Rasputin. Okay, the Russian generals were still in charge. Yes, Nicholas II would listen to his wife, but he didn't always take her advice. While the Tsarina was very much captivated by Rasputin's personality, the Tsar was less so. And he sometimes thought Rasputin was just weird. And a lot of the people that complained about Rasputin were the people looking to overthrow the regime. So again, they probably were exaggerating this. All of this, the truth doesn't matter. What matters is people believed that the Tsar was being manipulated by his wife and Rasputin, and that showed the Tsar as weak and ineffectual. And what they saw from the outside was a constant change of ministers who were meant to be leading the war and helping run the country, just being sacked left, right and centre. And they just believed this chaos was down to Alexandria, the Tsarina Alexandra and Rasputin, and that they were... And this is where the rumours about them having an affair and being critical of them came from. All this gossip just serves to undermine them. And even traditional conservatives who had supported the Tsar in 1905, they couldn't support him anymore. They just said, look, this is a mess. OK, how can we have absolute faith in you as leader when this is what's going on? So the Tsar's making a mess of it. The war's going badly. And there's not a lot of options going on. Now, one of the things that then happens, and it's meant to be a response to the Great Retreat, was the Tsar would eventually have to call back the Duma. Okay. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that actually at the start of the war, the only political party that opposed to Tsarism that was also in opposition to the war was the Bolsheviks. They were always opposed to the war. They saw it as a capitalist thing. The Mensheviks were divided on it, social revolutionaries too, and middle class parties, the kind of moderate Octoberists and cadets, they actually were really pro-nationalist. They really supported the war. So actually most of the opposition parties wanted to be involved in the war, and they wanted to help the war. But when the Duma was dissolved in 1914, they realised that the Tsar wasn't going to let them be involved. So they end up taking sort of voluntary action, forming something called the Zemstvo Union to try and give relief work, to try and provide munitions and support and help for wounded soldiers. There's another group called the Union of Towns was taken up, which tried to help manufacture war essentials like uniforms and so on. And what was telling about these voluntary organisations, one of them led by Prince Lvov, showed how the nobility and the middle classes could work together. And these voluntary organisations were actually, although small scale, they were much more effective than the official state system. And that just goes to show, was used as further proof of how out of touch and ineffectual the government of Russia was at this time. They didn't know what they were doing, and some voluntary organisations were much more effective. Now, under pressure from the Great Retreat, the Tsar will recall a new Duma. And so he recalls the Duma. When it meets in summer 1915, about 300 of its members, so that's about two-thirds of its membership, everyone except the extreme left and the extreme right, all grouped together into something called the Progressive Bloc. And what they wanted was they basically wanted a united government where, or unified government, I should say, where the Duma and the Tsar worked in tandem, okay, as equal partners, which actually is not that big of a demand. They just said, look, we want to help you win the war. We want to do our best and we want to work with you to win the war. So we want to be a partnership. And that might have been effective, might have worked. It's not that different from what the middle classes have been demanding for a long time. Even so, Nicholas II sees this as a challenge to his authority. And he says, no, I'm going to carry on doing everything on my own. And he dismissed any ministers who had anything to do with this Progressive Bloc. This just alienates all these middle ground politicians, particularly groups like the Cadets, who supported the Tsar. They want a constitutional monarchy. And they realised the Tsar was never going to compromise. And so these people who wanted to work with the Tsar, by the Tsar's actions, are pushed into opposition. And by the end of 1916, key figures in the Progressive Bloc are actually get to the point where they're trying to force Tsar Nicholas II to abdicate. So again, the Tsar has just made catastrophic mistakes again and again and again. There was also, don't worry about that. So that's the situation by the end of 1916. So what is it that triggers the actual revolution in February 1917? Well, the rate of inflation starts to accelerate a lot, and it really, really starts to hit home by the end of 1916 into early 1917, when the real terms wage fell by about half, mostly because of increasing food shortages, but other things as well. Rent was going up in Petrograd, and the workers couldn't afford their accommodation. There was a particularly harsh winter as well in 1916 to 1917, which meant fuel and heating was scarce and therefore very expensive. This is in no ways like the end of 2022. Anyway, all this caused labour unrest. And so the workers in towns and cities started going on strikes. And these became, again, nothing like the end of 2022. So this became a really serious problem, particularly because there was still the shortage of munitions. Now, it's estimated that in 1916, 750,000 working days were lost as a result of strike action in Petrograd. So that's the number of workers and the days each worker would have worked, so to speak, were lost. That's obviously a huge impact. And along with the not working, a lot of the workers are organised in trade unions, which is legal thanks to the October Manifesto. And they start demonstrating. And they start demonstrating for an end to the war and the removal of the Tsar. So the workers in the major cities now are rising up in opposition. So it's got an economic basis and it's channeled into a political solution. Then towards the end of 1916, unrest will start to grow in the countryside as well as the towns. Inflation played a part here, but actually probably other reasons were more important. The peasantry never really were that pro-war, and they just couldn't be bothered with it, and they couldn't see what the point of it was, particularly those that didn't identify as Russian. They were the ones who bore most of the human costs. It was because they made up the biggest part of the population. About 50 million men served in the Russian army, most of them peasants. Nearly 2 million of them were killed, and 5 million were wounded or taken prisoner. And most of these are peasant conscripts, people that have been forced into the war. And, you know, as the casualty list and the list of prisoners grows, so in the countryside, husbands, fathers, sons, brothers, these are the people missing, and resentment to the war is going to increase as the lists get longer and longer and longer. And of course, the loss of able-bodied men to the army meant much of the work had to be done by women, children and the elderly, and again, they didn't like having to do all this extra work as well, and weren't happy about it. There's also the fact that the army would regularly requisition equipment, okay, which basically means saying, we need it, so we're going to take it from you. It's kind of like legal theft, I suppose. We need it, so we're going to requisition it. And this would usually include things like horses and livestock. Now, the horses were used to do most of the heavy farm work. So the army took the best horses, meaning the rubbish horses were left, or no horses at all. And so humans would have to take on the work of pulling the ploughs and so on. And this was not good. Further resentment and anger. It's a bit like, I suppose, in a modern sense, it'd be like someone coming along and requisitioning your parents' car for the war effort. And you say, oh, right, so how do I... Oh, so now I have to walk everywhere. I have to walk 3 miles to school or something like that. That's going to build resentment. And also, soldiers' wives would be paid an allowance when the husbands were serving in the army. However, it didn't increase with inflation, so it became pretty pitiful. By 1916, peasant households were finding it really difficult to pay for any consumer goods like sugar and basic clothing. And again, 50% of peasant women would be unable to buy fabric at pre-war prices. And they ended up responding by looting local shops and stealing. And that, again, is going to cause a breakdown in the social order. So that's the situation. Now, what then happens in early 1917 is in Petrograd, huge amount of discontent in all sorts of areas. And in January, about half the city's workers go out on strike to mark the events of Bloody Sunday in 1905. So there's a link back there. And then there's a second major strike in early February. So these are really big and serious strikes that cause the city's industry to shut down. A week after this, Petrograd's biggest factory, which is the Putilov Engineering Complex, was brought to a standstill by a major industrial action. Now, the day after the Putilov factory was closed was International Women's Day, which was actually a socialist idea. It'd been created by the socialist parties around Europe and was first celebrated in 1911. So it was to try and promote women's rights in general, and particularly the rights of women workers. And so socialist activists, OK, so on the left, they tried to encourage Petrograd's workers to mark International Women's Day as well by holding yet another anti-government demonstration. So it's not so much that it's International Women's Day. It's the fact this is yet another serious strike and demonstration in Petrograd after a series that had come in January and February. Huge numbers of women as well as men come out. About 70% of the workforce in Petrograd's textile industry, and 20% of these are women, all of them badly paid. And yeah, and women still had to do all the getting bread and stuff like that. So the women textile workers in particular all go out shouting for bread and an end to war. And that causes 5 days of disorder in Petrograd. So the city basically descends into anarchy and chaos. And that meant the Tsarist regime had lost control over its capital city. So that's triggered by the International Women's Day revolt. The only way that they could try and restore order was to try and, use troops, the military, to come and restore order using military force, martial law, as we call it. But it was quite clear that the troops were unwilling to quell the disorder and were reluctant to actually fire on citizens, particularly women. And a lot of the troops had sympathy with them. By the 26th of February, they were trying to regain control of the streets. They were arresting known protesters and agitators, and they were putting in huge numbers of troops. Remember, these are troops who ideally should be fighting in the war, but this results in hundreds of demonstrators being killed in clashes with the military. And a number of the soldiers in the military realised that they might end up being forced to shoot on unarmed crowds. And that led to soldiers in one barracks mutinying. And this spread to other barracks, leading to army officers fleeing the city. And basically the soldiers end up mutinying and joining with the crowds and demonstrators. So you get a mixture of military soldiers, military personnel, ordinary workers and students, all protesting and basically refusing to obey orders or follow the rule of law or anything like that. So in this chaos, we get the creation of the Provisional Committee and the Petrograd Soviet. Okay, now no one had planned the February Revolution, okay, and it wasn't directed or controlled by any political leaders. It basically rose up as response to all the opposition, and it created a political vacuum. And two bodies end up trying to fill that vacuum. The first is the Provisional Committee of the Duma. Okay, so this had been created, on the day the Petrograd garrison mutinied. It was dominated by the leader of the cadets, Milyukov, and was hoping to restore public order and establish a new government that would enjoy public confidence. Ideally, one that would be kind of a liberal democracy, okay, so kind of middle class in tone. However, its attempts to seize the initiative were problematic. Basically, it wasn't actually an elected body, and certainly not by the ordinary people, because it was chosen out of the Duma. And so people questioned, well, how come you? Not actually elected or appointed by anyone. How come you get to take charge and make these decisions? So that was a big issue. Also, the Petrograd garrison that had mutinied was unwilling to recognise its authority. It said, no, we're in charge, sort of. And so when the soldiers ordered, when the Provisional Committee ordered the soldiers to leave and return to the barracks, the soldiers just ignored them. So the Provisional Committee really didn't have very much actual authority. It claimed it, but it didn't have any. Now, at the same time, we get the Petrograd Soviet. Now, this is a recreation of the St. Petersburg Soviet earlier. It's created by a group of socialists, most of them Mensheviks, actually, at this stage. And there's one big important difference. In the 1905 St. Petersburg Soviet, it was purely the workers. But now the Petrograd Soviet would elect soldiers as well as workers. And so this sort of military, this council of a union of working representatives who represent all the different factories. So this sort of workers collective would now also have soldiers and military expertise. And it would officially become, in March 1917, the Petrograd Soviet of Workers and Soldiers Deputies. So it's got military representatives as well as workers' representatives. Now, as a result of this, because it was championing the rights of workers and soldiers, the Petrograd Soviet quickly won the support of all the city's workers and its military. However, the leaders of the Petrograd Soviet were purely there to represent the interests of their members, if you like. They didn't want to form a government themselves. They wanted the country to be run by other people. They were just there to make sure the people they represented were being treated fairly. So a lot of them don't really want to get involved in the government. The Mensheviks in particular, they want to wait for a future revolution. They don't want to be involved in a current government. They know their limitations. They don't really feel they can govern. And also they were scared that if they tried to govern, they might end up in a civil war, which interestingly will happen later. So what ends up happening? Well, the Provisional Committee of the Duma and the Petrograd Soviet end up negotiating a bit of an agreement about how to proceed. The Petrograd Soviet says, okay, we'll allow a liberal-dominated provisional government drawn out of the existing Duma that can hold office while preparations are made to draw up a democratic constitution for Russia. And in return for this, the Duma liberals would accept the Petrograd Soviet acting as kind of a police or a watchdog, basically being the military wing, if you like, and ensuring that the provisional government did not betray the principles of the revolution. So this is a system of dual power that they will follow. And I'll talk a bit more about that next time. So by that stage, it is very clear that some new group is controlling the capital city and is dominating Russian politics. Now, at the start of this, Nicholas II is all the way in military headquarters. He's a long way from Petrograd, and he's having to rely on reports. And things are moving quickly in Petrograd, but transport to the front is not so quick. Initially, he was told it was no cause for alarm and not to worry. He did get some advice from the Duma president, who said, no, things are really bad. He said, oh, I'll ignore that. Who are you? However, after the Petrograd garrison mutinied, Nicholas II went, oh, this is really serious. Oh, no. And he ordered the generals to send troops to Petrograd to try and regain control. But the army high command said, nope, this is a waste of time and resources, and you're too far gone. And the army basically said, we no longer have faith in your leadership, Tsar Nicholas. You need to abdicate. And that was really it. He'd lost the support of the army completely now, and he'd lost control of his capital. So at this point, he says, OK, I can see what's happening. I will agree to abdicate in favour of my brother. So I don't want Tsarism to go, but I failed. My brother, Grand Prince Michael, can take over. And so the Tsar Nicholas abdicated, and the next day, Grand Prince Michael spoke to the Duma's leaders and he said, yeah, this isn't going to go well. You know what? I'm going to abdicate as well. I'm not going to take the throne. And that meant, quite quickly, monarchical rule, Tsarist rule in Russia was ended. Basically, because Tsar Nicholas, by early 1917, had lost confidence from all sections of Russian society, the workers, the peasants, the military, the nobility, the far left, the far right. I mean, there'd always been hostility towards the Tsarist regime amongst the middle classes and the working classes, but it just grew and became so much more intense. The war then had exaggerated this, had exacerbated these problems, and just shown the weaknesses of the Tsar himself, as well as the whole Tsarist regime. And all the problems that existed in 1914 had just become magnified and become just much bigger and much more severe. And effectively, in 1917, unlike 1905, the Tsar had lost all support from the army and his own nobility and bureaucracy. And having lost those supports, there was nothing he could do. The priority at this, the other issue is the ongoing war. And for the generals, for the military and everyone else, the priority is winning the war without losing a lot of territory. Well, winning the war and ideally doing it without huge loss of life and losing lots of land. And so everyone, regardless of whether they're pro or anti-war, were focused on that, not the Tsar. So the Tsar had no friends, no allies, no supporters. And that's really why he realised he'd have to abdicate and why Grand Prince Michael refused to take the throne. Oh, excuse me for that little cough there. So that basically is the February Revolution, and that's why it occurred. So World War One really triggers it, but it exacerbating earlier problems. Next time, I'm going to look at the provisional government and the dual power model in St. Petersburg and how they tried to govern Russia and the mistakes they made, the good points, the bad points. And we'll start looking at the course that would eventually lead to the October Revolution and bring the Bolsheviks into power. Hope this has been useful and helped you develop your understanding of how World War One led to the February Revolution. I'll be back soon. And I really do need to work out a better way of ending these. Anyway, I'm just going to say goodbye.